Welcome to Hollywood in Color, where I tell the stories of the stars usually left out of entertainment history. The people of color in front of and behind the camera who have been representing for over a century. I'm your host, Diana Martinez. For Hollywood, sound came at the perfect time. In 1929, when the American Great Depression devastated the entire country, the last few theaters were installing sound systems. This new and exciting technology enticed audiences to spend a precious 35 cents to see a talkie. But as the budgets of Americans got tighter, Hollywood became more reliant on international markets. But there was a huge obstacle to getting sound films to these audiences: language. Silent films told their stories through pantomime and intertitles, those black cards with text or dialogue on them. Intertitles could be easily translated and swapped out when exporting the film overseas or to Latin America. Hollywood had to find a new way to make their films accessible for millions of non-English-speaking viewers. In the last episode, we explored how having an accent severely limited the roles foreign stars took on. For Lupe Vélez and Dolores del Río, this meant playing characters more aligned with their nationality or characters whose exoticism was more important than their country of origin. There was a distinct feeling that the movie form was about to change drastically with the coming of sound. A New York Times columnist wrote, "The talkie will break up the unity of mankind established by the movie. The universal brotherhood of the sign language is menaced by the advent of the sound film." That was a little bit dramatic, but sound did challenge producers, directors, and writers in one significant way. They could no longer be ignorant to cultural difference. Arguably, the universal brotherhood of the silent film was founded in large part on an American and Western European lexicon. It was shaped by their biases, their prejudices, and their racist iconography. Sound, and hearing dialogue specifically, made foreign audiences more aware of Hollywood's shortcomings. It exposed how, for example, many American directors didn't know that Spanish was spoken differently in Spain, Mexico, and Argentina. That dialect was as important as language. During the 1930s and into the 1940s, Lupe and Dolores experienced the American hypocrisies and contradictions felt by Mexicans nationally. In the first years of the 1930s, they remain famous, but are relegated to secondary roles. Their exoticism is celebrated as millions of Mexican nationals living in the U.S. and American citizens of Mexican descent are deported and forcibly relocated. Then, between 1935 and 1955, more than 300 films feature Mexico or Mexicans in some way, a result of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Good Neighbor policy, which aimed to cultivate friendship with Latin America and prevent fascist influence in the region. These films created some of the most remembered Latino stars like Carmen Miranda, Ricardo Montalban, Desi Arnaz, Anthony Quinn, Fernando Lamas, and Cesar Romero. But they also strengthened the stereotypical images of dancing, singing Latinos so intractable from Hollywood today. For Lupe, language was both a barrier and an opportunity. She took part in Hollywood's brief but substantial venture into Spanish language filmmaking. For Dolores, Hollywood wasn't so kind, and eventually, Mexico called to her. In this episode, we look at Lupe's and Dolores' careers in the late 1930s to the mid-1940s, when both women leave Hollywood as it becomes an unwelcome space and place. This is the fifth and final episode of Lupe Vélez and Dolores del Río, Las Reinas of Los Angeles. Between 1929 and 1932, Hollywood made over 100 Spanish-language versions of their English-language films. English and Spanish versions were usually shot simultaneously. To keep costs low, studios attempted to use the same casts and directors, but this wasn't always feasible. Furthermore, it soon became apparent that cultural differences sometimes also called for large changes in the script. Offensive stereotypes were downplayed, and sex was censored. For some films, this meant the Spanish language version was more a loose adaptation rather than a simple translation. During this time, Lupe made 3 Spanish language versions of Hollywood films: 1930's Oriente es Occidente, where East is East, a 1931 remake of Edwin Carew's Resurrection, called Resurrección, and in 1932, a remake of the film The Cuban Love Song titled Hombres de mi Vida, or The Men of My Life. Among all the major Mexican actors of the time, Dolores was the only one who didn't participate in Spanish-language Hollywood productions. There were 2 reasons for that. Number 1 was that all those Spanish-language productions were made by the large and small studios Paramount, Fox, Universal, MGM, Columbia, and Warner Brothers. They weren't made by United Artists and RKO, the 2 studios Dolores worked with in the 1930s. These studios, instead, decided to dub and subtitle their films. The second reason is more telling of Dolores's management than her personal views. Spanish language versions of films usually had smaller budgets, less well-known casts, and were only distributed in foreign markets. Essentially, Spanish language Hollywood films were B films, less prestigious and in the eyes of critics, less watchable. Though Spanish language Hollywood films did well at the box office, they didn't receive good reviews, especially in Latin America and in Spanish-speaking American communities. One critic wrote, "After hearing the sound films that ruin our language, I would declare free entry to English-talking pictures." These films spurred debates among Spanish-speaking communities about the universality of their language, and inevitably, these debates also became about regional and national identity. In Spanish-language theater, whether in Mexico, Spain, or Los Angeles, Castilian Spanish was the default dialect. Castilian Spanish was considered sophisticated and elegant and would lend a certain prestige to films that were often badly reviewed. But the majority of Spanish-speaking actors in Hollywood at the time were Mexican and would essentially have to forsake their own language to conform to this aesthetic distinction. This war of the accents played out in Spanish-language press. When asked her opinion on the matter, Dolores del Rio argued that the accent should be intrinsic to the story. If the character was Spanish, she should use a Castilian accent. If she was Mexican, a Mexican accent, and so forth. Lupe was less diplomatic. She proclaimed that the use of a Castilian accent by a Mexican actor would be ridiculous in any context. She later had to apologize for that comment, but it evoked a sentiment that many Mexicans shared. After a long history of colonization by the Spanish, it wasn't lost on audiences and certainly not lost on the well-educated writers and cultural critics that arguments for Castilian Spanish also rested on a racial hierarchy that implied Latin American Spanish was a bastardization of a purer form. The influential Spanish-language newspaper La Opinión attributed the prioritization of Spanishness over Mexicanness to the lack of inclusivity in Hollywood. The paper pointed out the disproportionate hiring of Spanish writers and consultants and called out a blatant preference for Spanish actors. Virginia Fabrejas, a Mexican stage actress who worked solely in Spanish-language Hollywood films, told a magazine, "Mexicans in Hollywood have to struggle against the prejudice that they don't speak Spanish, but a Mexican dialect, and are forced to work for directors of Spanish-talking films that only know how to speak English." The 1930 film El Hombre Malo, The Bad Man, was set in Mexico, but had no Mexican actors in lead or featured roles. The supervisors and story consultants were Spanish. Fed up, a few Latin American actors called for a boycott of American Spanish language films, but the boycott never happened. By 1932, all studios except for Fox stopped producing Spanish language films. These films were more controversial than lucrative, and as the Great Depression wore on, studios had less money to invest in multiple productions of the same film. Though there were financial reasons why Hollywood would no longer make Spanish language films, it cannot be ignored that America's relationship with Mexicans had changed. There was a boiling hostility towards them. The Depression made white Americans, from the very poor to the elite, turn to xenophobic rationales for the failures of government and the limits of capitalism. Anti-Mexican propaganda claimed Mexicans stole jobs from Americans, while simultaneously being lazy and unemployed. Mexican communities were depicted as impoverished ghettos lined with fancy cars and respectable homes they paid for with welfare money. These irreconcilable contradictions about Mexicans were rampant in newspapers and magazines. President Herbert Hoover, in large part, initiated these anti-Mexican sentiments when he claimed that they were one of the causes of the Depression. He stopped all immigration and appointed Secretary of Labor William N. Doak. Doak controlled the Immigration Service, which at the time was housed in the Department of Labor. Their Depression strategy relied heavily on an informal program of deportation. Job growth was created by removing Mexicans from jobs and filling those jobs with white Americans. But the definition of Mexican extended far. It wasn't limited to Mexicans in America illegally, but also included Mexicans residing in the U.S. legally and American citizens of Mexican descent. In essence, anyone vaguely brown was a target. Hoover, through Doak, encouraged local governments to act autonomously, implementing whatever tactics they wanted to round up as many Mexicans as they could. Local authorities in states like Mississippi, Texas, and Alaska began mass deportation programs and targeted arrests. But Southern California, with its large Mexican population, was the site for one of the most infamous incidents of the time. On February 6, 1931, in La Placita Park, a large sunny square near Olvera Street, the heart of the Mexican Angeleno community, there was a massive raid. At exactly 3 in the afternoon, police officers from LA, San Diego, San Francisco, and even Nogales, Arizona, alongside U.S. immigration agents, surrounded the 400 park visitors. The scene was chaotic and frightening. Individuals were asked to show their papers, and authorities could choose whether or not to accept them. The raid lasted more than an hour. These incidents did not go unnoticed by those sympathetic to Mexicans. The Los Angeles County Bar Association condemned the agency's procedures and the wholesale violation of basic human rights in a report titled, "The Lawless Enforcement of the Law." In 2005, the California Senate passed Bill 670, the Apology Act for the 1930s Mexican Repatriation Program. It reads, "The legislature finds and declares all of the following. A. Beginning in 1929, government authorities and certain private sector entities in California and throughout the United States undertook an aggressive program to forcibly remove persons of Mexican ancestry from the United States. B. In California alone, approximately 400,000 American citizens and legal residents of Mexican ancestry were forced to go to Mexico. C. In total, it is estimated that 2 million people of Mexican ancestry were forcibly relocated to Mexico, approximately 1.2 million of whom had been born in the United States, including the state of California. D. Throughout California, massive raids were conducted on Mexican-American communities, resulting in the clandestine removal of thousands of people, many of whom were never able to return to the United States, their country of birth. E. These raids also had the effect of coercing thousands of people to leave the country in the face of threats and acts of violence. F. These raids targeted persons of Mexican ancestry, with authorities and others indiscriminately characterizing these persons as illegal aliens, even when they were United States citizens or permanent legal residents. G. Authorities in California and other states instituted programs to wrongfully remove persons of Mexican ancestry and secure transportation arrangements with railroads, automobiles, ships, and airlines to effectuate the wholesale removal of persons out of the United States to Mexico. H. As a result of these illegal activities, families were forced to abandon or were defrauded of personal and real property, which often was sold by local authorities as payment for the transportation expenses incurred in their removal from the United States to Mexico. I. As a further result of these illegal activities, United States citizens and legal residents were separated from their families and country and were deprived of their livelihood and United States constitutional rights. J. As a further result of these illegal activities, United States citizens were deprived of the right to participate in the political process guaranteed to all citizens, thereby resulting in the tragic denial of due process and equal protection of the laws. The state of California apologizes to those individuals for the fundamental violation of their basic civil liberties and constitutional rights committed during the period of illegal deportation and coerced emigration. The state of California regrets the suffering and hardship those individuals and their families endured as a direct result of the government-sponsored repatriation program of the 1930s. So the Mexican repatriation program was supposed to stimulate job growth. It didn't. And it hurt some of America's largest industries like agriculture, manufacturing, and the movies. Hollywood's conversion to sound was incredibly expensive, and the technology they used wasn't free. Studios sunk millions of dollars that they didn't have into production, distribution, and exhibition of sound films. They borrowed money from Wall Street's J.P. Morgan and the Rockefeller Group, who controlled Western Electric and RCA, the companies that held the patents for sound technology. The Great Depression put studios under a lot of pressure to continue paying back their debts. Though moviegoing in the U.S. remained relatively stable and, in fact, increased in the years right after the coming of sound, by 1933, Hollywood had also begun to feel the effects of the Depression. Newly elected President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a different approach to help the U.S. economy recover, one premised on stimulating international investment and business. Latin America was a target for fascist propaganda, so Hollywood was enlisted to devise media to counter anti-democratic and anti-American sentiment. When World War II officially began in 1939, Europe no longer became a viable market for Hollywood films, and Hollywood needed the Latin American market even more. FDR enlisted the help of Nelson Rockefeller to create the Office of the Coordinator for Interdepartmental Affairs. Rockefeller promptly established a motion picture department and enlisted the influential John Hay Whitney to head it up. Whitney, the president of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, had a long-standing relationship with Hollywood. He owned a stake in Technicolor and helped fund the film adaptation of Gone with the Wind. Whitney enlisted his friends Walt Disney and Orson Welles to make films that would represent Latin America in a positive light. He also insisted that the Production Code Administration, which was in charge of censoring objectionable content and ideology in Hollywood films, hire Cuban Addison Durland as a cultural consultant. Durland would make sure that Latin Americans were reflected well. Every image of Latin Americans until 1955 was carefully overseen by Durland. In 1939, Lupe released the comedy The Girl from Mexico. Lupe plays Carmelita Fuentes, a Mexican singer who attracts the attentions of Dennis Lindsay, an American advertising executive. Though engaged, Dennis strikes a friendship with Lupe and puts down a $10,000 deposit, ensuring her safe passage to New York. When she arrives, Lupe feels at home. New York is depicted as a bustling city of people speaking her native Spanish. She easily finds a job as a singer in a bar. She's heard by one of Dennis's most important clients, who is looking for a singer to promote a new perfume called Romance Español, Spanish Romance. Dennis's fiancée, the snobby Elizabeth, becomes increasingly jealous, and Carmelita begins to scheme to steal him away. She uses Dennis's clients to make Dennis jealous and make him declare his love for her. The final scenes of the film shows Dennis trading in his deposit for a marriage contract. FDR's good neighbor policy played a large role in allowing the happy nuptials of this on-screen couple. Unlike Dolores's Birds of Paradise, 7 years and a different presidential administration earlier, Lupe's Carmelita was deemed fit to become an American, at least by marriage. The Girl from Mexico was so popular that RKO Studios commissioned an entire series of Carmelita films, known as the Mexican Spitfire series. Scholars and historians are still undecided about the merits of these films. In them, Carmelita speaks heavily broken English and often acts uncouth and temperamental. She is put in increasingly ridiculous scenarios, which are clear by the film's titles like Mexican Spitfire Sees a Ghost and Mexican Spitfire's Elephant. But in pivotal moments, Carmelita also breaks into speaking Spanish that often mocks the white characters, unbeknownst to non-Spanish-speaking audiences. Carmelita is a sympathetic protagonist. It is clear we should prefer her to Elizabeth or Dennis's bigoted Aunt Della. And as the protagonist, Lupe carries the films almost single-handedly. The first time a Mexican actress helmed such a lucrative and high-profile series of films, although they were considered B-films. In the final entry of the series, 1943's Mexican Spitfire's Blessed Event, the film even teases something extraordinary: Carmelita's pregnancy. Though it is, in fact, her cat that is pregnant, the film's lighthearted treatment of the possibility of Carmelita being pregnant is new and unprecedented. Her possible pregnancy is hinted at as a joyous occasion, not an unbreakable taboo. The Mexican press and audiences had mixed reactions to these films. For some, the films were an extension of a long line of problematic representations of Mexicans. For others, Lupe was their star, an example of Mexican resiliency. Lupe's personal life became increasingly difficult in the months after the Mexican Spitfire series ended. She was dating unknown actor Harold Raymond, and soon she found herself pregnant. Raymond agreed to marry her, though he made it clear that he didn't love her. He was only marrying her to save her from the indignity of having a child out of wedlock. Lupe was devastated. On December 14th, 1944, Lupe committed suicide. She was 36 years old. She left a note that read, "To Harold, may God forgive you and forgive me too, but I prefer to take my life away and our babies before I bring him with shame or killing him. How could you, Harold, fake such a great love for me and our baby when all the time you didn't want us? I see no other way out for me. So goodbye and good luck to you. Love, Lupe." In 1965, avant-garde director Kenneth Anger released the now infamous book Hollywood Babylon. The book told sordid stories of celebrity misbehavior, and it was banned from bookstores within days. This made people only want it more. Since then, the book has been widely denounced by scholars and historians as fundamentally based on lies colored by Anger's own misogyny and racism. But that hasn't stopped his deranged fanfiction from becoming part of Hollywood lore. In a particularly callous chapter titled Chop Suicide, Anger detailed how Lupe was supposedly found dead, hunched over a toilet in a room that had been decorated lavishly for the occasion of her suicide by sleeping pills. Anger's death myth has circulated far beyond Lupe's work. In fact, it is usually the only thing people know about her if they've heard her name at all. Andy Warhol made a film about Lupe's death starring muse Edie Sedgwick. Lupe's story was used as a punchline in an episode of The Simpsons and the 90s sitcom Frasier. Mexican artists have created loving tributes to her, memorializing her image and finding a commonality with the girl from Mexico. Rita Gonzalez's video, The Assumption of Lupe Vélez, turns these American images of Lupe on their head to reclaim her influence. The video ends with a moving song performed by Chavela Vargas. She sings, "No soy de aquí, ni soy de allá. I'm from neither here nor there.
No soy de aquí, ni soy de allá. No tengo edad ni por venir y ser feliz es mi color de identidad. No soy de aquí."
Months earlier, Dolores had left Hollywood for good. The Mexican film industry was growing, and her roles in America were less fulfilling and challenging. She was done being typecast. She said, "I tried to interest my producers in stories about Mexico. I wanted to play a Mexican, but they preferred me to play a French woman or a Polynesian." At some point, all stars fade. If it hadn't been for sound, possibly Dolores and Lupe would have had longer careers, even greater success, which is hard to ask for as they were some of the top earners at their height. But what is surprising is how inaccessible their stories have been for so long, especially in America, where they made and shaped their careers. There's only one English-language biography of Lupe and one of Dolores. There are dozens on their contemporaries, Katharine Hepburn and Greta Garbo. We could say that Dolores and Lupe weren't famous for as long, or that their movies weren't as good, or that they weren't quote-unquote influential in the same way. We could say that. Or we could acknowledge that Hollywood is a prism through which American ideas about race are refracted, distorted, and projected. For a long time, and even now, American bootstrap philosophy has made us think that merit is all it takes to make it into history books. But there are other forces too. the same forces of bigotry and prejudice that downplayed the importance of people of color in shaping our cultural and national history. This history is out there, and it's waiting to be heard. This episode of Hollywood in Color has been produced, edited, and narrated by me, Diana Martinez. All artwork for the show was designed by Shelby Mooring. Every episode of this podcast is heavily researched. If you want info on the books, articles, and sources I used, check out the show notes. There, you'll also find info about the theme song and other music used in this episode. If you liked this episode, leave a rating of the first season wherever you listen to this podcast. If you have a little more time, a review would be awesome. Let me know what you like, what needs improvements, and of course, your ideas for future seasons. You can also get in touch on social media at HWoodInColor on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or through the website HollywoodInColor.org. And with that said, I can't wait to tell you another story next season, beginning June 19th.